Support for this podcast comes from Bryn Mawr Communications. BMC produces a number of informative podcast series spanning a variety of topics in optometry. Discover a new show at itube.net/podcasts.
Welcome to this episode of Modern Management of Vitreous Opacities. My name is John Kitchens, and I'm a retina specialist with Retina Associates of Kentucky. And I'm joined today by three wonderful panelists. First of all, from the Cincinnati Eye Institute, we have an excellent cataract surgeon, Dr. Allison Early. Allison, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Welcome. And my good friend and colleague, a retina specialist from Baylor College of Medicine, Dr. Christina Wang. Christina, good to see you again.
Hi, John. Always good to see you and look forward to the discussion.
And finally, last but not least, we have Dr. Walt Whitley, who is an optometrist of Virginia Eye Consultants and the chief medical editor of Modern Optometry. Welcome, Walt.
Hey, thanks, John. Excited to be here and be part of this discussion.
So before we get into the program, let's preview this three-part miniseries. In this three-part miniseries, we're going to really talk about the collaboration between optometrists and ophthalmologists, retina surgeons, and how that's really critical in assisting patients who are experiencing vitreous opacities. We're going to cover the full gamut of eye care represented here. We're going to have optometrists, we're going to have comprehensive ophthalmology represented, we're going to have vitreoretinal specialists represented. We'll rotate the moderator for each episode, and we'll discuss surgical innovations, examination, and referral tactics in these episodes. Today, though, we're going to focus on the value of gathering and documenting patient history. So let's jump right in and talk about the really key critical things we want to elucidate from a patient history. Now, Christina, you do surgery for vitreous opacities. Talk to me about what you like to hear from a patient as far as the history, complaints, and whatnot are concerned.
Yeah, I think for this particular condition, John, history is so critical. And I know we're going to get into that a little bit later. But findings on the examination and even our very specialized ancillary imaging may not always reflect the symptoms that patients truly are suffering from. So history is critical, is the first thing to emphasize. What I really like to hear are really three things. The first is duration. I like to hear how long they've been suffering and experiencing and being bothered by these floaters, because we know that the majority of patients who experience a posterior vitreous detachment or have vitreous opacities will neuroadapt over time. Usually that takes place over, 3-6 months, sometimes a year, but a lot of times they won't notice them eventually. So I like to know how long they've been experiencing those symptoms. The second is really trying to get a gauge on severity, and really drilling down into that becomes the third part, which is how it's impacting the activities of daily living and the things that they enjoy in their life, trying to get a grasp on visual function. Are the vitreous opacities preventing them from playing their tennis or golf? Is it preventing them from driving, reading? I try to get a gauge on those activities.
And Christina, what about prior history of ophthalmic surgeries, cataract surgery, history of retinal detachment, other things such as that? Is there anything that is more inclusive for these patients or exclusive from your consideration for vitreous opacity removal?
Yes, of course. I mean, the entire past ophthalmic history is really critical in factoring that into the risk-benefit assessment for these patients. And first of all, I think the patients that are kind of the ideal patients, we would all agree, are the ones who already have a full posterior vitreous detachment and are pseudophakic. It doesn't mean they have to be categorized into that group to have vitrectomy for vitreous opacities, but it definitely, I think, lowers some of the risks that can be associated with performing vitrectomy for this condition. Additionally, any other retinal pathologies are important to note. If there's something that might be causing those symptoms or contributing those symptoms, you want to make sure you note that, because then you know how to counsel them and what they can expect. If they have an epiretinal membrane, for example, John, doing a vitrectomy for vitreous opacities without peeling the membrane may not help the symptoms that they think are attributed to the vitreous opacities. So I do think that it's important to take a detailed ocular history as well.
Now, Walt, I'd like to come to you next because you're on the front line and you have your finger on the pulse of optometry. Do you feel like optometrists are starting to gain a greater appreciation for the impact vitreous opacities have on patients? And do you feel like they're finding a formula to figure out who to refer? And if so, what is that formula?
Yeah, this is something that we're talking about more and more as we learn about that there are options that we can refer our patients for. And, you know, these days, many of our patients, they're already coming in and they've already done their research and they've been suffering from floaters. And I had a patient today I was seeing for dry eye and she goes, "Oh yeah, hey, can you tell me a little bit about this this procedure called a vitrectomy for vitreous opacities?" Or, "Hey, actually, I looked up, I was going to go see this guy in Texas that does lasers for floaters and vitreous opacities. Can you tell me more about this?" And I said, "Well, today we're still taking care of your dry eye, but this is something we can definitely talk about." And I said, so I just went back through our history. But, you know, having that conversation, of we've all spoken on calls like this before. And, you know, I've worked with a couple retina specialists as well who are upstairs from my clinic. And so, you know, they have told us that this is a great option for many of our patients. And this is something that you need to make sure you're talking with your retina specialist and seeing, is this something that they do? Who are the patients, just as Christina just mentioned? And what is that history like? And when is it time for the appropriate referral?
Allison, from the cataract surgeon standpoint, do you find that you are becoming more and more aware of patients who are bothered by vitreous opacities after cataract surgery? And do you think there's any correlation with premium IOLs?
I definitely think that patients are more likely to notice their floaters in the time following cataract surgery. And that can really be for more than one reason. Sometimes patients now can see so much better and they have much better contrast sensitivity that they can appreciate floaters that were already there, but maybe didn't bother them if they had a very significant cataract. And also, as we know, patients following cataract surgery are more likely to develop a posterior vitreous detachment if they didn't already have one. So those symptoms can be acute and very noticeable to a patient too. So it is really important to carry the patient through their whole post-operative course and make sure that they're aware that there are options if the floaters are really intrusive.
And what do you think the role of the general ophthalmologist cataract surgeon is in this whole dynamic of referring patients for evaluation for vitreous opacities?
Well, I think, as with any diligent provider, we would all agree that history taking is extremely important. So as a cataract surgeon, I often have patients come in who are referred for a cataract or do have a cataract, but upon discussion, it may come out that a significant complaint of theirs is related to their vitreous opacities. So I actually just saw a patient yesterday who I have seen a few times. She has mentioned floaters in the past. Now she is developing a visually significant cataract. And I felt that it would be appropriate to consider a surgical treatment for both the cataract and the vitreous opacities at the same time. So it's important to gauge where the patient is in terms of other ocular disease, how much their vitreous opacities are actually a complaint. It may not be the reason that somebody makes an appointment, but it could be a secondary complaint that's still very high on the list.
That's a great, great point. That careful history taking we're hearing over and over is really so critical. Christina, we brought up an interesting point with Allison, and that is vitreous opacities and cataract. How do you address both of those issues from the retinal standpoint if a patient does have both happen?
I think there's different approaches depending on the retinal surgeon you talk to about this. For me, if a patient is phakic, and they have a full posterior vitreous detachment and their cataract is moderate to advanced, I think this is actually a great opportunity to perform a combined approach where you actually will go in, work with a cataract specialist, they remove the cataract, and then I follow and perform a vitrectomy for those vitreous opacities. And I think those patients are extremely happy because you're taking care of two problems in one. Of course, it's very important, as we all talked about earlier, to sort of tease out and make sure that those two components are both needed. And usually they are, especially if the cataracts are moderate or advanced. And that's because, John, as you and I both know, after a vitrectomy, most patients are going to have progression of their cataract anyway. So I like to take that opportunity to address both at the same time. If the cataract is mild, however, and it's true, you know, after I've teased out the symptoms, I really feel like it's the vitreous opacities that are very bothersome to the patient. They've been present for 6 months. They continue to be severe and affect their activities that they enjoy doing in their life. I will occasionally take a patient, even if they're phagic, for vitrectomy to treat the aspect that's bothering them, but I carefully counsel them preoperatively so that they fully understand that they are going to require another surgery, probably in rapid succession within a year or so, to remove the cataract. But most of the time, the patients who are coming to us are already at the age where they have a little bit of cataract anyway, and they are bound to need that second surgery at some point. So, you know, again, it's all about how you approach the patient. That being said, I will say there are cataract surgeons who will only take pseudophakic patients. And, you know, I think that's fair for their own reasons as well.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, Christina, I'm someone who really does like patients that are going to have a vitrectomy for vitreous opacities to be pseudophakic, because I like to be able to open that capsule during vitrectomy, because the last thing I would want is that patient didn't have a YAG and have another floater thereafter. Plus, I really like doing vitrectomy on pseudophakic patients. I don't like causing a problem. I also know that it can be technically a little more difficult to do cataract surgery after vitrectomy surgery in some eyes. And so I just love pseudophakia. Walt, I'll come back to you for one last pearl. For our optometry colleagues, what is the one pearl when you're seeing a patient that has kind of mixed mechanisms for their decreased vision? They have cataract, they have vitreous opacities. How can you help sort that out?
And well, that's a great question, because that's going to come down to the history and just going and looking at the timing and saying, hey, tell me what's bothering you most. Is it the decreased vision? And if it's constantly decreased, then we're going to gear more to the cataract surgery. But if it's truly the vitreous opacities that are bothering them, they're going to say, hey, I have this blurriness that comes and goes. I see these dots. I see these lines. And, you know, this has been bothering me for several months or years, or whatever it may be. And then I just keep listing, and that's what's bothering them versus a cataract versus anything else. And so that's when I would tell them, hey, we have an option. I work with some surgeons that can address this for you. And so I set the stage and then make the appropriate referral for them. But it's all about the history and asking the right questions.
So we're going to pause the discussion here for a break. And when we get back, we'll discuss the utility of standardizing patient history in the form of a questionnaire.
Support for this podcast comes from Bryn Mawr Communications. BMC produces a number of informative podcast series spanning a variety of topics in optometry. Discover a new show at itube.net/podcasts.
Welcome back to the miniseries, Modern Management of Vitreous Opacities. I'm your host for this episode, John Kitchens, and I'd like to explore whether standardizing patient history in the form of a questionnaire is beneficial, feasible, and whatnot. So, Walt, I'm going to start with you here. Let's talk about the possibility of a questionnaire. First of all, do you use questionnaires in your clinical practice? And if you do, what do you use those for? And would you see a questionnaire that a patient fills out being beneficial for the evaluation of vitreous opacities?
Well, I work in a surgical practice, and we love questionnaires. And depending on what specialty you're in, I oversee a lot of the dry eye clinic. And so we utilize a speed questionnaire. We know our cataract surgeons, they have their lifestyle questionnaires. And Allison can speak on this of, you know, which would be most appropriate to implant for the patient's lifestyle. As for vitreous opacities, this is not something that we've utilized, and not something that we've even talked about in the past, but I'm interested in learning more and what your thoughts are on this as well, because, you know, that's always been a question, is when do we refer a patient for vitreous opacities to either you or Christina? What are some of the symptoms that patients have? And that's a lot of questions that many of our colleagues have, is, you know, how long do the patients have to have it? And if we want to start a questionnaire, well, we can just do it right now. So how long they've had it, you know, how frequent does it bother them? You know, what is their main symptom? Is it always there? And whether it's a yes or no, or sometimes maybe, I mean, we could add these questions in, but this is a great start to a discussion on, would we see it valuable right now? It's just, it hasn't been a thought, but I'm open to your thoughts as well.
I think that's a great point. Well, before we get to Christina to answer some of those questions, Allison, as a cataract surgeon, do you use a questionnaire, and how helpful is it in your decision to do cataract surgery?
I think one of the great benefits of having a questionnaire, especially if you're considering patients who might be interested in premium intraocular lens surgery, part of that, a major part of that decision-making tree is really getting a good assessment of the patient's personality, functionality, lifestyle, interests, activities. And in my experience, I've found that there's quite a lot of overlap between the patient who is interested in a premium IOL and the patient who's significantly bothered by their vitreous opacities. I think they tend to be people who are very high functioning, great attention to detail. So there's a lot of people who may fall into both categories. So it hasn't occurred to me to use a questionnaire to screen patients for vitreous opacities. I think it might be really useful though.
All right, Christina, so you've heard Walt and Allison both kind of say, yeah, you know what? Theoretically, this would make a good case to have a questionnaire. I'm going to ask you first, do you think a questionnaire would be a good idea? And then the second thing is, what should be on that questionnaire?
It's a great thought. It's not something I've done or thought a lot about, but I'll tell you what's nice about this idea is that it will help us objectify the parameters that we're using in our decision-making and hopefully standardize more so the overall process. And it might even actually help lend itself to better inter-provider communication, because a lot of times the, you know, as retina surgeons, we're often the sort of the final step. We get referrals from our comprehensive ophthalmology, general ophthalmology colleagues, and our optometry colleagues as well. And so I think that sometimes with those handoffs of the patient, some of the information may get lost in transition. And I think a survey would be nice for that reason. If we were going to have some kind of questionnaire like that, I think it would have to include all the elements we discussed earlier. Duration of symptoms would be really important. Severity of symptoms on some kind of quantitative scale would be important. And then, of course, really drilling down to specific functional impact. How is the patient truly bothered? What activities are they struggling with? And I think there would also need to be a fourth component, really gauging the readiness of the patient. Are they actually interested in doing something, you know, like surgery to help fix this problem? And I think you'd have to take it another step, John. I think we would have to validate it somehow. I can envision some kind of scoring system where we would then see how patients with baseline scores correlate with how they do post-vitrectomy. And then we could arrive at some sort of tipping or threshold point when patients should actually be referred, when patients should actually be operated on. But again, I think this is all theoretical, and I'd love your thoughts too, John. I mean, you know, we've had these discussions before about vitrectomy for vitreous opacities. And there's so much variation, not just between patients, but even between ourselves with what types of patients we actually feel comfortable taking to the operating room. There's also the subjectivity of patient reported outcomes and how their functional impact is affected by them. So, you know, this is really where there's a lot of art to medicine, right? There's a lot of science and technology, but there's also a lot of art in deciding who those ideal patients are. And I just wonder if a questionnaire would be best fit for that type of decision-making, but it's a thought, you know, there would be a lot of work that we would have to do with it. I mean, what do you think?
You know, what I think is so great as I'm listening to you talk about this, about a questionnaire is number one, it gives that patient that time as they're filling out the questionnaire to really think and be introspective about, are these things bothering me? So they might not have thought about some of the questions that would be on the questionnaire and go, oh, you know what? Yeah, that does bother me when I'm, you know, reading. Yeah, it's a level 5 on a scale of 0 to 5 as far as my driving ability or whatever it may be. So it gives them a chance to sit in the waiting room and think about their symptoms. The second thing is it allows me to see the patient's report in almost more exacting detail before I walk in to see the patient. Because now what I have is I have my referring doctor's note that sometimes is sparse. I have what my technician has written down as the patient's chief complaint, which is sometimes sparse. And I have to go in and discern, is it really floaters bothering this patient or vitreous opacities bothering this patient? Or is it cataract or dry eye or whatnot? And so if we can really narrow that down before I ever walk into the room, I can imagine that a lot of my questions that I spend time with the patient going over will simply be answered on the sheet. And I'll say, hey, I just want to confirm that these are the things bothering you. Let's talk more about the procedure, you know, or let's talk more about how this could or couldn't help you. So I think it's interesting. The final thing is having some scoring. And I love the idea of having a post-procedure scoring. will give us a metric to be able to show exactly how much this helps patients. We see it every day. I mean, listen, when you, some of our happiest patients are the patients that we remove these vitreous opacities on. It can be life-changing and they are so grateful, but we can't quantify that because they come in 2020 and they leave 2020. But the happiness level is 2010. They are just off the charts as far as happiness. And so having something that could be scored and graded would help us in a big way with that.
You know, John, I'm listening to you talk about this and I'm going back to the dry eye clinic because we have a validated questionnaire. If a patient score, we use a speed questionnaire. If it's 6 or 7 or higher, we're doing some type of dry eye treatment. If we're doing a procedure, we see them back in about a month and we give them the same questionnaire. And roughly, they're going to do about 50% better on a daily basis on how their eyes felt. And so just listening to you both of you, all three of you speak, and listening to having objective numbers to see the improvement in their quality of life.
And now, Walt, has that been something that's now being used in research? How valuable is that, or how mainstream is that in the optometric community?
So there's a small percentage, I'm going to say maybe 15-20% are utilizing questionnaires, whether it's going to be the OSDI, the EQ5, or the speed questionnaire. But you know, whether you're using that or asking the questions, I think having the questionnaire works much, much better and much more effective for that. I think the issue is, and I hear this from colleagues when I'm telling them, hey, you should try a dry questionnaire. I could say, hey, try this vitreous opacities questionnaire. Like, well, people tell us to use a questionnaire for contact lenses, for whatever spectacles they're wearing. And so it can go on and on. So where that fits in, that's going to be a question.
Allison, in cataract surgery, what, obviously you have metrics, how close you get to emmetropia and, you know, complication rates. Do you use questionnaires for the success rates or how bothered your patients are, particularly how much improvement they've had afterwards?
Personally don't, and I think that could be a really useful tool, though. You know, many cataract and refractive surgeons utilize questionnaires ahead of time, but I can't say I've really heard much conversation about going back and using the same type of questionnaire postoperatively, but that would be a very useful metric to have.
Very, very interesting. So I certainly think that there's a opportunity there for perhaps dry eye specialists kind of lend some of their experience with questionnaires. And certainly, Christina, to us gather some like-minded retina specialists and see if we can come up with something that could potentially be validated. That could be extremely valuable, not just for grading our patients' problems, their successes, but then eventually justifying this to insurance companies. Should this come under scrutiny? What do you think, Christina?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love hearing what other people have commented on because this is a new idea. We don't typically use any sort of questionnaire in any of our retina procedures preoperatively. So for this, especially coming back to the fact that you can't always rely on objective data the way you can for something like an epiretinal membrane or even a cataract, I think it's important to have tools like this that can more objectively gauge how the patient's being impacted. So it's important for communication. We talked about that. It's important to gauge how the patient is. You can almost use it as an extension of your history taking, which we talked about in the first session. But you're absolutely right, John, that at the end of the day, you also need, it's hard to show sort of those functional improvements to sectors like payers. And something like this could really help do so.
Yeah, and Christina, you bring up one last great point, and that is we don't have a good diagnostic for vitreous opacities. You know, patients oftentimes come with good visual acuity and we don't have a great way to image them. And it's always shocking to me when I get inside of an eye and a patient who really complains about vitreous opacities to just see how many vitreous opacities are there. And I always underestimate in clinic how bad they are till I get in the operating room and have that direct visualization. And it's tremendous. So with the lack of a good diagnostic imaging tool, a questionnaire is probably going to be the best option.
Maybe we could include in the questionnaire a patient description of the shape of their opacities, because I personally always enjoy the creative reports of a floater the shape of Italy or something like that. It's always fun to hear.
Yeah, we have some very descriptive patients that will just tell you, like, in so much detail, the floater that's bothering them. Some have named them, actually. So I agree. It's there's certainly a lot of opportunities for us to, I think, improve this very new and up and coming condition and therapeutic option for our patients. Well, listen, that's it for this episode of Modern Management of Vitreous Opacities. Join us for our next episode in which Dr. Walt Whitley will be moderating a discussion of the examination and referral of patients with vitreous opacities. On behalf of the panel, I'm John Kitchens. Join us here next time. Thanks for listening.